Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. It is Wednesday, February 27th. My name is Rob Dosser. I have a fun show on the way for you today. I was able to catch up with my buddy from ESPN, Dallin Cuff. We talked about everything that happened in college basketball on Monday and Tuesday night, from Tyler Hero going crazy to Fran McCaffrey going crazy to Duke's loss without Zion Williamson and what Buzz Williams did to kind of counteract that. We talked about the Ivy League tournament. We talked about whether or not Dallin Cuff is a walking bucket. It was a really good conversation. I do think that you are going to enjoy it. Before I get into it, I got to make the usual ask. Please rate, please review, please subscribe to this podcast in any app that you listen to podcasts in. Any interaction that you have with this episode or this series really does help. It helps us in the metrics. It helps us in the rankings. And the proof of that is that for the better part of the last 2 months, this podcast has been ranked as one of the top five to top 10 podcasts in the college and high school bracket on iTunes. That is big for us. It makes my bosses happy. They are really happy. It makes me happy. I am really happy. And you are getting better shows as a result of it. So I appreciate all that you guys have done, everybody that's rated, everybody that's reviewed, everybody that has said nice things about me, even the guys that have said some mean things about me. I still love you guys. I cannot carry any hate in my heart. Let's get into that conversation with Dallin Cuff. And now let me welcome back onto the podcast the only Arsenal fan that anybody should be friends with, one Dallin Cuff. He is actually on his way driving from, I believe it is, do you fly into Bradley?
Yep, flying to Hartford. I'm en route to Bristol right now, ESPN right now.
You're going to have to go spend all night hanging out with Sean Farnham on set, and nobody really wants to do that, so I decided I would do my best to try to distract you without having to think about that. Before we actually get into the stuff that happened last night, you did have a tweet this morning that I wanted to talk to you about. I know you are an Ivy League guy. You played at Columbia, and today, it was either this morning or last night, the Ivy League announced that they are going to have their Ivy League tournament on campus. And I think it's, what, 2020 is at Harvard. And Harvard. Then, yeah, and so it didn't seem like you were too happy about that. Talk me through why.
Because the release is now they're going to go through a rotational program. So they're going to go through all eight schools by 2025. And my issue with this is it's not good for the event. Like, I was not happy that it's going to be in Yale this year. And that's no knock against Yale or Payne Whitney Gym or James Jones or any of that. They're deserving hosts, but the best venue in our building, in our league, is the Palestra. It has the history, it has the seating capacity, it has the atmosphere. It was an outstanding television event that I got to be part of the last 2 years. And maybe it'll come through in Yale this upcoming year, but it's, you know, it's remains to be seen. There's only fits like 2,000 and change. It's smaller capacity, and I don't love the chance to be at every rotation because I don't think that's as good for the league. I think it should be at the Palestra. And if we're going to end up in Hanover, New Hampshire in possibly 2 years, that is just mind-boggling to me that we would have the tournament at Dartmouth that has, needless to say, not exactly a tradition or a real fervor for sports. I'll throw my alma mater in there. Does Columbia deserve to host it? Probably not. Holds just over 3,000 people. You know, the team has been down for a very, very long time. If they sneak in as a four seed, do they deserve to host it? I don't know about that. I'm the only positive for that is at least it's New York City. At least you're going to have people that want to be there. I mean, going to Hanover, New Hampshire, going to Ithaca in mid-March, no knock on those places. I just don't think that's great, great for the league. Philadelphia, Palestra, the history of the city, it's got it all there. It can handle the event. And if we're not going to do that, be the top seed. You win the regular season, you get a chance to host the tournament. You've earned it. I'm totally on board with that. The rotational, you know, democratic approach plan, I just don't like.
Yeah, I do like the idea that the team that wins the regular season title ends up getting to host the tournament, because I'm always for the teams that are able to do something over the course of the season, getting the most advantage they can when it comes to conference tournaments and the chance to actually get to the NCAA tournament. But I'm with you about the Palestra, man. If you're not going to do that, put it in. There aren't, what, maybe eight buildings in all of college basketball that have more history and are more storied than what the Palestra is. Why don't you take advantage of that? That's the marquee thing about your league. So
you're going to give it eight? Because I don't know about eight. I know maybe like the Barn is older in Minnesota and Levity's Pavilion even in our league, and Harvard is technically older. But I mean, like the actual the history that exudes from the Big Five and the big games played there, and NCAA tournament games played there, and the success Pennant had in the past. I mean, there's so many stories to weave in, so many great Ivy League contests played in that building. To not have access to that, leverage that, makes no sense. And to go to places that could be as sterile as could be, I mean, in Cornell, I'm not sure the town's going to turn out for that. Like, I just don't think it's not good for the league. And I understand the coaches not wanting to be at the Fletcher every year. That was the biggest issue when Penn was the best team in the league last year, arguably. They get to play on their home floor and they win. Granted, they had to use an away locker room, but that doesn't really matter. It was their floor, it felt like home. Okay, you don't want to do that. I get it. Let's go to the top seed. This ridiculous democratic approach of everybody's got to get a chance. No, that's not how it works. That's not how our league has worked for 60 years. That's not how the league works now. We've got three schools offering grants versus other schools offering financial aid. There, we don't have a level playing field to begin with. Why are we going to go be democratic with where the tournament should be?
What do you think of the tournament? Like, how has it played out for you so far? You've been a part of it for the first two times. So what do you think of it? Is it going as well as you hoped it would?
Yes, I think it's been excellent. I mean, I think the league deserves it. I think when I played in the league, you know, Penn and Princeton were on top, and the other six of us were really battling at scraps, and maybe we could, you know, we'd knock them off every now and again, and we make it interesting. But those two teams are winning that league, and I was part of that last generation where they saw that. 07, Cornell was the first team that won, and things became a little more, you know, like other leagues in the country where it's not just two teams for 50 years, essentially, that dominate the league. So I think it's been great. The top four, it's been a battle for teams to get in that top four. That fourth spot has been coveted. This year, actually, I think the league, I mean, from Princeton to Yale, Princeton, and Harvard are three teams that any one of the three could win and win the tournament. And I think that's great. And the fourth team, if it's Brown, Brown's been battling and has had some good wins. They deserve to be there with a chance at the table. I think to have the top four is good to qualify to get in. And it's not everybody, which, again, I agree with that approach. And I think our league right now is the most – by KenPom, I think the most games in the country decided by 6 points or less or overtime. So it's been a highly, highly competitive league right now. And I think that it's been great. It's been great to this point. I think the tournament will be awesome this year. I'm looking forward to it. But how we've decided to structure this thing going forward, I'm not a big fan of. Obviously.
Yeah, I do like that they have the tournament because it means – I think you made this point the last time we talked about the Ivy League here because it keeps teams at the bottom of the conference engaged. You know, if you are – 2-8 right now in conference play, then you still have a chance to end up making a run and maybe getting that four seed if you can win out. So I think it kind of helps the competitiveness for the entire season instead of having, you know, 2/3 of the league being basically not playing for anything. Last thing before we move off the Ivy League, do you think Yale has any chance of getting an at-large bid? And what do you make of Mieoni as an NBA prospect?
Oni is he's an NBA player. He's a draftable guy, and that's not me just thinking that. That's me talking to numerous scouts. Let's say I've talked about the 20 or so scouts over the course of the year. I did one of his games down at when Yale beat Miami early in the year, and then I've gotten a bunch of Yale games because on Friday nights, I know it looks like I'm on TV because we tape everything, a little TV magic behind the curtain there, but Friday nights I'm not actually there, so I leave Bristol and I drive down to Yale, so I'll see them again live for probably the fifth time this year, but every game I go to, there's between 2 and 5 scouts there. And I'm talking to guys, and I've made some calls to different guys that I know too. And everybody seems to be convinced. He's a draftable guy, you know, anywhere from 35 to 50. And you see his skill level's really high. His body, he's got an NBA body, 6'5", about 220, long arms, can shoot it out to an NBA range with ease, can finish above the rim on guys, around guys. Got a great pull-up game. They all say he can defend. He'd be a real, you know, 3-and-D type guy. The biggest issue with him is he's got to make better decisions. I mean, he can be a bit turnover prone, and his skill level is really high, but at times he forces bad positions and makes bad decisions with the ball. And that's the biggest knock on him anytime you talk to a scout or you just watch him play. It's evident he should be a 2-to-1 assist to turnover guy. He's not that yet. That said, you know, not many guys choose to leave the Ivy League early to go into the draft and not be a first-round guy. I'm not sure the last guy to do it. I know my coach at Columbia that recruited me there, Armand Hill, he left after his junior year at Princeton and was a 7th overall pick. That's not the discussion we're having here because Oney's not a top 10 guy. But if he wanted to leave this year, he could be a draft. If he wants to wait till next year from talking to those guys too, I know age is a big deal in the NBA, but I don't. That year ain't going to move him at all significantly up or down, I don't think. Maybe he really shows out and makes better decisions and creeps into the back half of the first round. Which back end of the first round, which would be great. That kid is an NBA player, an NBA talent. That America may get a chance to see the tournament, but it's not a foregone conclusion because, as I already said, that league is really, really difficult. And those other top teams, as Harvard just did last week, can beat them on their floor.
The thing I love about Oney is, one, I'm from New Haven, and he plays at a college in New Haven, so I always got to rep that. And the other part of it is that he was originally he originally committed to Williams back in like 2014 before anyone really knew who he was or how good he was. And I played Division III. Williams is Division III, so I got to rep that too. So Mie Oney is my guy. What would have been interesting is if he
Hold on, real quick. By the way, if he would have played at Williams, dude would have scored like 4,000 points. Now, yeah. Williams is high level hoop. Still, it's a different animal than playing at where he's playing right now. And it's mind-boggling that's where he was going to go. And from that to being an NBA player, you know, a la Duncan Robinson, it just shows guys slip through the cracks, man. Not everybody knows what they're talking about when it comes to evaluating 17, 16, 18-year-old kids.
The craziest part of all of that is when he was getting recruited by Williams, that's when Duncan Robinson was a freshman and before he left. So yeah. If Duncan Robinson doesn't transfer – and Mie Oney ends up going to Williams, that team could have had two NBA players on it. Think about that.
That's wild.
I think they would have won a couple of Division III games. All right, so let's talk a little bit about Duke. They obviously don't have Zion Williamson. Last night they lost at Virginia Tech. It was the worst defensive performance that we've seen out of Duke all season long. They gave up 1.222 points per possession. Their previous worst this year was against Gonzaga, the nation's best offense, and that was only 1.208 points per possession. I'm diving a little bit deep into the stats, but, Dallin, let me ask you this. What do you see from Duke on that end of the floor without Zion on the floor?
It's always nice for the stats to illustrate what you see with your eyes. Because I didn't look at the points for possession, just watching the game, especially the last 12 minutes. Like, man, they have been really bad defensively. And really, it's not just Zion. The guys didn't play a cohesive game together. You know, there was constantly dribble penetration. This is without Justin Robinson playing for Tech. They were able to get downhill multiple times. Bede was getting in the lane, especially able to facilitate and kick things out. I mean, Kerry Blackshear is a great player, one of the best bigs in the country, as you know, Buzz Williams made sure he said last night, make people like me repeat, but it is true. And they didn't have much of an answer for him, whether it was on the interior or the exterior. He's able to put the ball down about 16, 17 feet and make a play. Just all around, their ball pressure was bad, their ball containment was bad, their rotations were bad, their decision-making was bad. Even on the last key play, that outlaw three, Bede gets going downhill, and Alex O'Connell helps off the strong side. And you cannot help off a guy that's shooting almost 50% in league play from three on the strong side. You got it. Now that rotation should be coming from the weak side big man, the big man or the weak side guard, man. It should be coming from the strong side guard. He made a poor decision there defensively, leading to a wide-open three, but it was keyed by the fact that, again, he was able to get in the lane. So all around, it was a poor performance. Now, Zion, sometimes, as I've said on air, he can cover up some guys in six. You know, he can be back there at times. You can really pressure the ball because he's coming over, ball-hawking, adjusting shots, blocking shots. Maybe if he's back there, O'Connell doesn't help. Maybe O'Connell does what he's supposed to do on the strong side and stays there. Maybe he says, like, oh, okay, Zion's back. He'll be fine. Their on-court execution, it affects mentality from the guys playing against him and the guys playing with him. There's no intimidation factor there. That exists. I mean, the guy's getting a couple blocks a game and gets a couple steals a game, and he can disrupt and help Duke disrupt stuff. So when he's not in the game, you know, things change from an actual X and O standpoint and a mentality standpoint. But that said, Duke's capable of being a better defensive team. Last night was remarkably poor. I'm not even sure Zion's not going to cover up all those things. They got to do things better, but missing him does definitely hurt.
Yeah, a lot of that credit has to go to, as you mentioned, Kerry Blackshear, who was absolutely terrific. And I think you have to give credit to Buzz Williams too, because he really, I mean, he cracked the code on how to kind of beat that Duke defense. What they more or less did, especially in the last 12 minutes, was if Marquise Bolden was on the floor, they used Kerry Blackshear to put him in a ball screen. And with like four guys around the perimeter that can all shoot 40% from three, Duke didn't really have a chance. And then if Javon Delorier was in the game, he's better at guarding ball screens, they would just throw the ball into Blackshear and let him bury Delorier in the post because Delorier doesn't quite have the bulk. And I think where they missed Zion was that they could have used Zion at that five spot. Like this was the perfect example where you can go to that, the death lineup, if you will, and let Zion be the guy that he can jump those ball screens, and he can also he's strong enough where he's not going to let Blackshear just kind of back him down. So I thought that's where they missed him more than anything. What do you make of this Virginia Tech team? You know, I wish they had Justin Robinson back, man, because he is so good. But that was the first time they've really looked like a dangerous team, I think, since he's been out.
Now, you're absolutely right. That was the thing is they've learned now to play without him, and that's been the hardest part. I mean, you mentioned Buzz Williams, and that he's got to be up for ACC Coach of the Year, without a doubt. When you lose your point guard, your lead guy that helps set the tone, defensively for sure, but offensively keys everybody, and you've got a great offensive team, and things are rolling, and he's taking out a lineup, and you have to figure out how to play in the middle of ACC play. And they took there some lumps early on. I mean, they did it. They really hung their hat defensively. I tipped my cap to them to say, like, hey, man, guys, we don't have the same dude on offense. We need to get stops at a high level. And they really locked in on that side of the ball. I mean, NC State scoring 24 points was more indicative of NC State being terrible that night or that day. But Virginia Tech was really good defensively, and they started to be consistently good defensively to keep themselves in games. But that last night was the first performance against a high-level opponent where they looked like they could really compete and do some damage. So I credit it to him to how he's been able to adjust his team and then his players to respond to it and to maximize the opportunities. I mean, guys have all stepped up in a different role. Nikhil Alexander-Walker is one of the best off-guards in the country. You know, at the beginning there, he was asked to do more and dictate more of the ball in his hands. Not necessarily his strength, but he's figuring it out. Bede coming in and being able to kind of run the show at times has really helped. He's elevated his play. The shooters, as we talked about already, the shooters have shot the ball well, and last year has been excellent. So I think the coach has done a great job of remaking what they want to do. The players have all really elevated their level of play, and now the question is, if Robinson comes back, and at what point in time can he get back into the mix? And I'm always a believer in one of those things, if you can fold that guy back in, the experience and the confidence that other guys are playing with, if they begin to play well without him, goes a long way to pushing your team to a different level. We'll just see if they have enough time left in the season to make anything happen.
What do you make of Nikhil Alexander-Walker as a pro? Because I think he's a guy that is going to end up playing, like, I don't know, like 10 or 12 years in the NBA. I just think that he is such a perfect fit in terms of, you know, he can make open threes, and he's 6'5 with long arms, and he jumps passing lanes, and you can put him in ball screens, and he's a good passer, and, you know, he can go, he's ambidextrous more or less. So where do you fall on him as a guy at the next level?
I think you've got to be a little – I think he'll be a good pro. I think he does need better with the ball in his hands, and that's a little bit of a development situation where he's got to continue to be – confident that he can initiate offense at times because of how the NBA is going at times. You're going to have to be able to want and take the ball off the bounce and do your thing. Not that he can't do it, but you see when he's been had to be the primary guy initiating offense sometimes, he has struggled. And sometimes his offense has taken a back seat, and he doesn't necessarily set the table for others as well yet. But I do think, to your point, he's long, he can knock down shots, he's athletic. I mean, that's a guy that I think he can still grow into his body a little more, develop a little more physically, have a little more strength to him to be able to finish, you know, a little through contact at times at the rim at the next level. But he's going to have a good career. Just the question of when he comes out. I assume it's going to be this year, but we'll see.
Yeah, he's definitely seen his efficiency kind of take a little bit of a dip since Justin Robinson has been out. He's been forced to play a little bit more of that just purely lead guard role, which I don't know if that's necessarily what he does best. Did you have a chance to watch the end of the Wisconsin-Indiana game last night?
I did not get to watch the end of that one yet. My afternoon film session will be the last 14 minutes of that game.
Well, the last 14 minutes of that game is probably had about 14 minutes of monitor reviews. It was as bad as the end of the Tennessee-LSU game, which was...
Yeah, that was brutal.
There were a lot of reviews. How do you feel about that? Like I'm always of the mindset that you should probably go and get the call right at the end of the day, especially if we have the technology to be able to go and figure it out. But at some point, you just got to say, like, enough is enough, man. It completely takes the air and the energy out of the game and out of the arena. And what makes, at least in my mind, college basketball such a special sport is the environment that you play in. I don't think we really have anywhere else like that in American sports. And I don't know. It's just when you have to go and add like 1/10 of a second to the clock when there's like 3.8 seconds left in the game, it's getting to be a little bit too much, I think.
Yeah, I agree, man. That Tennessee LSU game, talk about a buzzkill. That might have been one of the best games we've played all year. That was definitely the best game on Saturday, because Saturday played ended up being a bit of a dud comparatively to some other Saturdays we've seen. But that noon game on Saturday was tremendous shot making, playmaking, high level, great energy. A lot on the line between LSU and Tennessee, and just repeated monitor reviews just killed us. And now Yeah, that is the beautiful beauty of Synergy Sports. I'll be able to watch that game today in retrospect and skip that stuff. But you can't do that as a normal consumer. So when you're watching the game, and none of us can. So what I would say is I think they have to clock it. I think there's two things. You got to clock it first and foremost. Give me like 90 seconds or 60 seconds once the refs hit the monitor. Because there are times when we see it right away, and it should be done. It should literally be, boom, one look, we're out. Like, you don't – there are times it's so quick, but still that remains being a 3-4-minute review. That should never happen. The other part is when things are a little more complex, you put them under the gun, you give them a time frame, and, hey, if we can't tell, we can't tell. We got to live with it. You know, if it's still debatable after 60 seconds, it's going to be debatable after 3 minutes or 4 minutes. Like, let's just move along quickly. And the last thing, I do think that the technology is there. We want to have things right. We don't want to have a – you know, LSU-Kentucky situation where I know the goaltending wasn't reviewable, but if it is, you don't want to have a play like that, which is an obvious error, determine a game. So that rule needs to be changed, but more so the actual review of it. I'm for doing it. I'm not for the time that it takes, and I think we need to focus on that. The last thing I will say about it is sometimes the refs have to be confident in their calls. I feel like these guys go 38 minutes where they can't be told they're wrong, really. And then the last two, because they have the monitor, they're more than willing to doubt themselves. I mean, if you see it, you see it. There are times where you don't need a review, and they call it anyway just because they want to make sure they're right. We've already trusted you the past 38 minutes of the game. If you think you're right, you think you're right. If another official comes and says, we need to look at that, fine, different story. I don't like when there's like an out-of-bounds and the ref makes a call and he goes right away and points to the monitor if it's 1:50 to go in the game. Because at 2:01, he has to make that call and we all live with it. So I think we need to find a way to – there's got to be a balance here we find right now, because right now we just keep skewing toward these longer reviews, everything's reviewed, don't question myself, want to be right, and it's just it's become mind-numbing at the end of game.
Yeah, the funniest part, and you're not going to get this on Synergy, because, by the way, like, Synergy has me so spoiled when it comes to watching games. It gets hard for me to – like, I've tried to record as much as possible so I can just kind of plow through them throughout the night. And even then, I'm just kind of like, I can't do this, man. Hitting fast forward and hitting play again is really just, I'm spoiled, man. I've become a little bit soft and with all of that. But what you're not going to see is at some point at the end of the game when Demetric Trice goes to the foul line, he got fouled shooting a three with like 10 seconds left of the second.
Yeah, I saw the highlights. I didn't see that yet.
Yeah. But the best part was like there was a review at some point in between him shooting his second and third free throw. I don't remember what they were reviewing, but they were reviewing something. And so to kill, like, the dead air, they sent Molly McGrath into the crowd to interview Demetric Trice's dad in between the second free throw and the third free throw.
Oh, I saw that interview in the highlight at FDP, and I'm like, why are they interviewing? I came in this morning. It was, like, whenever I was got out of the gym, it was, like, 5:15 before I got on my flight. And I see her interviewing Demetric Trice talking about free throws, but I came in the middle of the highlights. So I had no idea what was going on there. Then the highlight online doesn't include that. It was just, like, the plays. So she's interviewing to talk about, like,
She's interviewing the dad in between the free throws because they have nothing else to talk about. Like there's been already like 10 minutes of whatever they had planned to talk about during the reviews and all of that. There's nothing left. It's double overtime. It's almost midnight. You could tell Dokic is ready to go home and they just send Molly McGrath into the crowd to talk to the dad, and the dad doesn't really say anything. He's like basically like, I just hope he makes these free throws. You know, he's a good free throw shooter, whatever. It was a very surreal moment. I've never seen anything like that before. Did you see what Fran McCaffrey did last night?
I did see that. Again, saw that on replay. I watched part of that game early this morning. But, I don't know if it is par for the course for him, but he's got a little bit of a reputation in that regard.
Yeah, and afterwards, apparently he walked by a media member for it was either the Toledo Blade or the Columbus Dispatch, walking behind the referee screaming, "You cheating mother effer, you're an effing disgrace,"
yep.
As he chased the ref down a hallway. Which, where do you stand on this? Because I think it's gotten to a certain point where I don't know why Iowa needs the embarrassment that they're getting from all of this. Like, how many times are you going to have the same guy give you negative headlines like this? Like, last year he was ejected for running onto the court at Maryland to argue a call. 2 years before that, he was ejected from a game against Wisconsin when Iowa was winning for, I forget what call he was arguing, but he ended up chest bumping the referee, got suspended for a game, $10,000 fine. 2 years before that, He flipped out in like a 30-point loss against Michigan State and ended up breaking a chair on the court. I think there was a game at Siena where he got ejected and then his wife got ejected from the crowd when he was coaching there. At what point are you Iowa and do you say, like, do we really need to keep having this kind of embarrassment for a guy that's won two NCAA tournament games in 8 years? It doesn't make sense why you would do this for a guy that's not. I mean, I could understand if it was like Tom Izzo or Coach K or John Calipari who's going to win you a national title, but two NCAA tournament games in 8 years for this?
Yeah, I don't know, honestly, I don't think it's about your record on the court. I don't know if any school should really support that. I'm not asking for him to be fired. I think it's a trite expression. It's a bleak cliche. People might laugh at it, but you are teaching these 12 to 15 young men how to be men, how to conduct themselves in what is supposed to be a professional atmosphere. You get boat raced by 20 on the road, it ain't about the refs. Like, it's not the refs' fault. Like, they may think they missed calls, but at the end of the day, the message to your team that should be said, not just in the words, which I'm sure he said in the locker room, that, hey, guys, we need to be better at this, we got to improve here, it's in your actions, too. If your actions, if you're MFing the ref on the way out of the huddle, off the court, you think your actions are not reflective of what the message that should be going to these young men or how to conduct yourself. The other things you're talking about are more broad. Now, again, his son got teed up during the game, too. It's not like, I mean, his dad's doing, his kid obviously models his behavior after your father and your parents and after your coaches a lot of times in your life. And he's doing that to his own detriment and his team's detriment. I really think that there has to be some sort of repercussions for him to continually do this. And it's not even about the wins and losses. It's just about how you should be conducting yourself. And I know coaches go off the deep end at times, and they can be. I'm all for coaches coaching their guys hard, getting in their faces. They love them, and they want to teach them how to play and how to be a man and all these different things, how to be successful in life. A lot of these things are going to be thought of and talked about in your life as you go forward in whatever profession you set out to do. But, you know, to model yourself or look at that behavior and think that's the way you conduct yourself, that's not what I would want my kid to be doing. And I think that anybody that recruits against them can say that type of stuff because it's been a pattern of behavior for years. These aren't isolated incidents. These aren't one-offs. These are things done towards the officials and towards, like, administration and other people, not necessarily even to his own players in terms of how to coach them.
Yeah, if I was the official, I would have turned around and said, hey, look, I'm not the one that gave up 29 points to Justin Aarons. That's the reason you lost the game. It's not me. That guy scored – he was freshman career high 9 points. He had 29 on you guys. That's why you lost. It wasn't anything that I did. Last thing I got for you, Dan, and then I'll let you go. So last night, Tyler Herro went nuts, right? He had 29 points, 9 for 10 shooting. He played some pretty good defense. He's a better defender than I realized. A lot of energy. Makes some mistakes still. But the moment that really stood out to me was he got fouled with, I want to say there was 5.3 seconds left. He goes to the foul line. Kentucky's up by one. He makes the first free throw. Someone on one of the Arkansas players is saying something to him while he's at the foul line. They zoom in on him, and you can read his lips. And he says, I'm wet. I'm a bucket, makes the second free throw, and then stares the Arkansas player down. Have you ever done that during a game?
Yeah, there's 100%, especially the free throw line. There's one place I was ultra confident on the line, end of the game, give me the ball. And there were times where, because guys, you do. I've done it on the other side. You try to get in guys' heads, you say some stuff. And in my head, I was like, I'm always cash money. I would say it, or I know I've said it sometimes, especially in high school. I've definitely said it in high school. But in terms of in my head sometimes, like if it was a big situation, I would literally say to myself, I'm cash money. Like there's no doubt. I'm a 90% free throw shooter. This is going in. And that was just, you got to be able to have that type of confidence when you're at the line late in games. And that kid is not black swag in any way, shape, or form. And he backs it up, whether it's knocking down shots. To your point about his defense, too, that whole team is really, they do a good job of getting through screens, fighting through screens, and being visible on the defensive end without fouling for the most part. The best team in the FEC in terms of their efficiency numbers, they rebound the ball well, and he does all those things really well for a guard. I think there's a lot of the young guys on that group have come in with a focus to learn and improve on the defensive end in particular. We knew he could shoot it, but his ability to create sometimes off of just coming off those pin down screens, he curls in the lane well, he scores off those, he facilitates off those. He obviously knocks down shots and defends at a pretty high level and rebounds well for a guard. His game has gotten better month after month, which is a credit to himself and to Coach Cal. So he has no reason to be. Not be confident, and he plays like it. He shows it. And that team right now is just keeps getting better and better. Now, the first 20 minutes last night wasn't pretty, but they found a way to battle out of it. And their second 20 minutes is more reflective, more indicative of who they are versus the first 20 minutes against Arkansas last night.
Yeah, and I was actually really impressed by that because it wasn't hard to figure out that this was going to be like the game that they're going to end up overlooking. All right, like the phrase we always love in college basketball circles is that's a trap game. You know, they're coming off of a big game at home against Auburn where they blew Auburn out. And on Saturday, they are going to Knoxville to play Tennessee for what could end up being the game that decides the SEC regular season title. And in between, you just have this regular old home game against an Arkansas team that's near the bottom of the conference. So it's not surprising to me at all that they slept walked through the first, whatever, 15, 20, 25 minutes. And to be able to bounce back from that and to win a game when you don't play well, I think says a little bit about the metal that you have as a team. And last thing, and then I'll let you get out of here. PJ Washington, is he was not great for the first 2 months of the season. He has been one of the best players in all of college basketball for the last 6 weeks. If you were assigned with picking like an All-American team or an SEC Player of the Year award kind of a deal, how much do you value what he did at the start of the year when he wasn't playing well versus how dominant he's been towards the end of the season? Because I can see where you can make the argument that he deserves to be SEC Player of the Year over Grant Williams, but Grant Williams deserves to be on an All-American team over him. And I know that's kind of counterintuitive, but it makes sense in my head.
And it makes sense in my head. Well said. That's exactly the way I look at it, honestly. And I think that's a lot of how coaches and media people that cover a league look at that award with SEC Player of the Year. Like, who owned our league? If they end up being the champs, now, I will say this. Don't sleep on LSU, because LSU beat them both, and they're playing without Tremont Waters again last night, won that game, and they have an easier path. Well, Kentucky or Tennessee have to lose on Saturday. LSU doesn't have to lose. Tigers are right there. I think TJ right now is taking this award away from Grant, based on how he's played last. And I think it's interesting, the ability, physical talent, and you saw flashes of it, but to have it consistently, we just couldn't see. And I think one of the biggest things with him was confidence and what is my spot on this team? How do I fit on this team? And this team took a little bit longer than some of Cal's teams, just in terms of us to understand how they're even going to play. I mean, the first month of the season, the defense was a mess. Offensively, they didn't really sure what they were. And it just started to click right before Christmas, and really start to understand, okay, here's how this guy works. Here's how we're going to play defensively. We're going to be committed. And they started to kind of click. And then the last piece of the puzzle really was PJ being like, oh, we're doing all these things. We're going to play through me a lot. I am the man. I'm going to be the man. Like, coach keeps telling me, you know, and get frustrated with me. That's part of it. Like, Cal coaches his guys hard, and he's getting frustrated with me. He's not understanding. And it kind of started to come together. And now they play through him, and he's just been absolutely outstanding. Efficiency's been great. He's a mismatch nightmare. Defensively, his length covers up some mistakes for guys. You know, 7'3" wingspan is a big difference. He's knocking down threes. He is playing like the guy we all thought he could be at the beginning of the year. It just took him a couple months to get there. But, I mean, if they close this thing out, he is the SEC Player of the Year in my mind. But to your point, Grant may more likely be on an All-America team because he had the first 2 months he was one of the best five guys in the country, where PJ was not. Right now, PJ's one of the best five guys in the country.
Well, listen, Dallin, I appreciate the time. My one request is going to be, since I'm assuming you cannot call Sean Farnham a cheating mother effer on TV, is tonight at some point tell the camera that you are a bucket. Say, I'm a bucket. That's my challenge to you.
I'll see if I can work that in. Farnie, I would like to see his reaction if and when I say that. But I do want to tell you, I always appreciate being the emergency backup guest. I'm here for you anytime, man. Anytime you need me, I'm ready to roll.
Well, I knew you were going to have some time to kill on a drive. So, I was just trying to do you the favor. I've made that drive many times, man.
Thank you, man, for having me. I appreciate it, Rocky.
That's not the most fun drive in the world. So, Dallin, I appreciate the time, man.
All right, man. Anytime.
Thanks for listening. Follow me on Twitter.
Give me 5 stars.